Would you believe it? Someone thought iron coins were a good idea. Friday Night History 71, Season 3, Episode 5, Square Coin, Square Hole. So there's an image of East Asian coinage, specifically copper coinage, that we need to grasp before we begin this week. Sometimes they're rounded, sometimes they're squared off, but generally they'll have a hole in the middle for ease in transport in strings of cash. In China, the iconic coin is the Yongle Tongbao. Had to get the tones right. Yongle cash, named for the Ming Emperor who ordered their minting. These were especially intended for international trade. In Japan, they're better known by their Japanese name as Eirakutsuho. They entered Japan in huge numbers during the lively Sino-Japanese trade during the Muromachi era and were so ubiquitous that they even made it onto the battle standards of Oda Nobunaga. Japanese coinage is older than this. The 7th century Fuhunzen was the first, minted while Japan was still actively adapting aspects of Tang-era Chinese administrations. Perhaps a better-known example of early Japanese coinage was a few decades later in 708 with the minting of Wado Kaiho. But it was Yongle Tongbao that had the most salient influence on Edo period copper coinage, starting from Kan'e Tsuho in the 1670s. There were several other types of coins. If you grew up with Pokemon, you might remember the coin on Meowth's head, which is supposed to be a ryo, a gold coin. But today, we're focusing on copper cash and its variants. Anyway, let's get back to our topic, shall we? Fast forward to the late 18th century. In 1784, the shogunate issued permission to Sendai Domain for the minting of its own coin. But unlike previous historic examples we've considered, this coin was iron rather than copper. The shogunate had issued such permission to Sendai Domain before, several times across the 17th and 18th centuries to that point. It wasn't the only domain to make their own money in the region. Achita Domain, Morioka Domain, and Aizu Domain all issued their own forms of money, be it paper money or coin. Sendai Domain's coins were minted in the port city of Ishinomaki, in the neighborhood even now called Isenba, the mint. Why they were minted in Ishinomaki and not the domainal capital of Sendai had to do with geography and transportation networks. The Kitakami River ran from the border with Nambu Domain on south across nearly two-thirds of Sendai Domain's territory down to the delta in Ishinomaki. Today there are two deltas, but back then there was just the one, emptying south into Sendai Bay. In Ishinomaki itself, there were roads that ran south as well as waterways that led west to Sendai. Naturally, it was also a deep water port, and from Ishinomaki you could also send ships anywhere in Japan at large, so it was a convenient crossroads by land and by water. When the farmers and townsmen turned things into the government, like salt or tax rice, it would go down the river network, first to places like Ishinomaki, and thence to Sendai itself. So what was up with the coinage? And why was it iron? Iron sand deposits are abundant in this part of Japan. This is also why this part of Japan is famous for iron teapots, even if they bear the name of Nambu, the next domain to the north of Sendai Domain. So it's not too strange to me that they used iron rather than copper for the coins. If you're listening to the podcast, check out the blog post for an image of one of the 1780s era coins. It's a square with rounded corners, a hole in the center, and surrounded by the words Sendai Tsuho, Sendai Cash. It was minted in several sizes, the largest being over 23 millimeters in diameter, just a smidge smaller than a modern US quarter. The shogunate's permission to Sendai Domain to mint it was for 5 years, and to restrict its distribution to within the domain's borders. This was, at the risk of gross understatement, a bad, bad time in Sendai Domain. The Tenmei famine and the resulting financial crisis and population crash were devastating to it at the time. To paraphrase the words of one visitor to this part of Japan in those years, it was like the music died. The ambient song one might have heard in the fields when passing by was gone, because people were either dead or starving. When I wrote my dissertation, this was the chapter I dreaded writing the most, because it was just the prelude to basically a half century of more or less non-stop suffering that never entirely went away. The Tenmei famine got overshadowed by the later Tempo famine, and even in a time when there wasn't a famine, northern Honshu was in some measure of constant agricultural and resultant duress. One crop failure after another, it was kind of bananas how awful a time this was. People were dying, starving, and the long-term impact of all of this was a pretty big reason why, in 1868, the conditions were not there for the North to have a meaningful chance at winning the Boshin War.
In a way, it's a little bit depressing to think that the North's fate at war was sealed so far in advance, but it's important to remember, as we've mentioned on the podcast before, Fernand Braudel's concept of la longue durée.
What this is, in short, is that rather than privilege the action of individual humans, it puts them at the bottom of a three-layer continuum. At the top is the role of the environment in shaping history, the things that happen in the very long term. In the middle is the level of what Braudel calls the history of groups, collective destinies, general trends. Things like the second and third order fallout from a famine, for instance, belong at this level. Finally, at the lowest level is that of events, politics, and people, history of individuals with which the general public is more familiar. It's not that human agency is meaningless, but rather, its immediate reach is modest. A little depressing, perhaps, but I think also humbling in a good way. We are, after all, small creatures in the grand scheme of things. So in the face of all of that, increasing the availability of cash was supposed to help and was part of a broader set of shogunate initiatives meant to address the crisis presented by the Tenmei famine. This was immediately prior to and during the tenure of Matsudaira Sadanobu, the famed shogunate reformer who we've mentioned before on this podcast. You might remember our episode on Gesaku. Sadanobu was the shogunate minister who tried and failed at banning Gesaku while being an avid consumer and writer of Gesaku. What the minting did instead of help was that the coin's initial value quickly plummeted, and with about 308 million of them minted, they flooded the market in Sendai, flooded the market in neighboring domains, and eventually reached the markets outside the shogun's front door in Edo. The shogunate revoked permission for their minting in 1787, 2 years early, but they kept circulating further and further away from Sendai domain. For a coin meant to help one domain's economic woes, this coin was everywhere! It was, as they say, an entire thing. The mint in Ishinomaki continued operation until the end of the Edo period, but in 1806, fed up with the worthless square coins that were the numismatic equivalent of glitter in how they got everywhere, weren't worth anything, and never seemed to go away, the shogunate cracked down on their use altogether. Sendai domain had plenty of other issues at the time too, not least of which was a ballooning debt to a hostile Osaka businessman named Masaya Heemon, so I figure it wasn't too much of a blow beyond the extant troubles. The shogunate, too, had plenty else with which to concern itself. From the sharp uptick in Russian incursions to the increasing appearances of American and British vessels off Japanese coasts to issues of internal relations to the imperial court, and more besides. And by the way, that old mint in Ishinomaki? Well, a good portion of its footprint remains at a vital crossroads and serves the public as Ishinomaki Station, just across the street from City Hall. The southern fork of the Kitakami River empties into Sendai Bay, not too far away to the east. It seems that worthless iron coins notwithstanding, some places retain their names and relative importance despite the changing times. And with that, I will see you next week. I'm Nairi, and this has been Friday Night History. Now, questions? Friday Night History is a historical romp with me, your favorite history dyke, Dr. Nairi A. Bakalian. Our theme is O Hayashi from Paratune, licensed under CC 4.0. This podcast is brought to you by my Patreon patrons, so thank you to Sorcha, Catherine, Emily, Eric, Jan, Bob, Ryan, Sean, Ennis, Faith, JD, Kaz, Rita, Dinsdale, ALC, AO65, Amy, Daphne, Dr. Yakumo, Lemur, Gnarl, Irene, Jesse, Catherine, Katie, Laura, Maeve, Mark, Nora, Sinan, Aura, Bewick, Charlene, Charles, Danny, Deborah, Emily D, Emily R, Julie, Gabe, Jacob, Jax, Jocelyn, Kathy, Kim, Mary, Phoebe, Phoebe Z, Relia, Rueri, Lisa, Susan, Tora, Zandra, Allison, Amy, Andrick, Bruce, Charlotte, Colin, Flitterkit, Jack, Kelly, Lane, Natalie, Fuong, Planes, Sam, Samantha, Vera, Ines, and Zoe. I couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you so much, and remember, who you are and what lights your fire is worth fighting for. North Star forever. I'll see you around.